Support for Central Florida Public Media comes from Addition Financial, offering their Savings Plus account with a 4% annual percentage yield. Serving Central Floridians since 1937 and was recently named one of Newsweek's best regional credit unions. More at additionfi.com/NPR. Applicable on savings up to $5,000. Rate subject to change, federally insured by NCUA.
The next great space telescope. You're listening to Are We There Yet? The radio show exploring space exploration. Hi, I'm Brendan Byrne. The next space-based telescope is almost ready to head into space. The James Webb Space Telescope aims to look deeper into the history of the universe, piggybacking off the incredible observations of the Hubble Space Telescope. It's undergoing final tests before getting packed away for shipment to French Guiana, ahead of a launch currently slated for Halloween. The massive telescope, made with 18 mirrors and a shield the size of a tennis court, will peer deeper into space than ever before, capturing photons in the infrared from the dawn of our universe. We'll speak with NASA's Lee Feinberg, optical telescope element manager, about the mirrors and this last leg of testing before launching later this year. Then we'll speak with our panel of University of Central Florida physicists about the next step in space-based observation and what's ahead for the science community once it launches. The James Webb Space Telescope, that's ahead on Are We There Yet? Here on WMFE, America's Space Station. The 18 gold mirrors of the James Webb Space Telescope look like pieces of art, a shiny beehive of polished glass that glimmer against the black telescope. But they're an important piece of the observatory, focusing ancient photons into the telescope's sensors, looking into the infrared history of our universe. Lee Feinberg is the optical telescope element manager for the James Webb Space Telescope and joins us now to talk about the importance of these mirrors. Lee, thanks for speaking with us.
Happy to be here.
So when you look at the James Webb Space Telescope, there are these mirrors, and they are just absolutely gorgeous-looking mirrors. Tell me about them. What are they made of? And they're just so brilliant. Why is that?
Well, let's see. They're made of very interesting materials. The mirrors themselves are made of beryllium. And it's funny because a lot of people look at the mirrors and they see the front surface, which is the coating on the mirror, which is gold. Mm-hmm. And of course, they look beautiful. But if you're an engineer, the beauty of the mirror is actually when you look at it from behind. And that is because these mirrors are incredibly lightweighted. And their fact, partially what enabled the mission was the ability to make mirrors that are 10 times lighter per unit area than the primary mirror of the Hubble Space Telescope. If we had flown a primary mirror that had the same mass per unit area as Hubble, we would not have been able to get it into space. The rocket would not have been able to get it up. It would have been too heavy. Mm-hmm. And so we had to develop a lighter weight mirror. And we also needed a mirror that would work very well at very cold temperatures. Webb is a infrared telescope that operates at about minus 400 degrees Fahrenheit. And so we needed a material that has really good properties when it gets really cold. And it turns out beryllium is this amazing material that both is super lightweight, but at the same time very strong, mm-hmm. and works really well at cold temperatures. So we made it out of beryllium. The beryllium is machined from the back, really like with a rib structure that are about the size of, you know, a piece of paper in terms of the thickness of the ribs. And then on top of that beryllium mirror, we have a coating, mm-hmm. which is the gold coating. And the gold is there to reflect the infrared light. It does a really good job of that. That's why we choose gold.
And how many mirrors are on the telescope itself?
Yeah, there's 18 mirrors. They're hexagonal shaped. And they are on actuators, which allow us to move them around a little bit. And so we'll position them, you know, finely in space. But there's 18 of them on the primary mirror.
Mm-hmm. I mean, this is probably one of the most important parts of the telescope, right? I mean, this is what directs the light into the receivers, right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, when you build a telescope, it's always about the primary mirror, and it's the largest mirror in the system. It's really the key mirror. It's the one that defines the resolution of the system. The bigger that mirror, the better the resolution, And when you work at longer wavelengths, resolution goes down, so you need an even bigger mirror. So when you work in the infrared, you need a really large mirror if you want to have the kind of resolution that you have on Hubble, which is in the visible. So that's why it's so key. And it you know, one of the problems that we had was the mirror is so large. The mirror itself, if it had just been a single mirror, would not have fit in the rocket. Mm-hmm. So not only did we have a mass problem, but we had a, how do you fit this in a cylindrical rocket that's only about 5 meters wide? And that's why we have two wings. We have these wings that unfold. They're kind of like a folding table. And each wing has three mirrors on it. So we have 12 mirrors on what we call the center section, which is a very large composite structure. And then we have these two wings that are on hinges, and they have motors that deploy them in space. But when we're in the rocket, we're all stowed up and the wings are sort of folded up.
Mm-hmm. Give me a sense of scale. When all of these mirrors are unfolded, what's the size of this, you know, reflective surface? How big are we talking here?
It's about 6.5 meters diameter, the primary mirror. And in terms of area, we're talking over 25 square meters.
That's crazy big.
Yeah. For a space telescope, this is large. This is, you know, significantly larger than Hubble, which was 2.4 meters. So this would even be large for a ground telescope, to be honest with you. I mean, there are really large ground telescopes, but this is a huge telescope.
And you said the size is really to capture these wavelengths in the infrared. Is that kind of the only advantage to size? Or, I mean, what else can you do with such a large telescope like this? What other advantages does it have?
Well, yeah, I mean, there's two key advantages. I mean, one is, as I mentioned, the resolution. But the second one, which is as important, is what we call sensitivity, which is the ability to capture as many photons coming in as possible. And I sometimes, you know, like to describe photons kind of like raindrops. Mm-hmm. If you think of these little bundles of energy. And these happen to be, you know, infrared wavelength photons coming in. But we want to capture as many as possible because, you know, one of the main drivers for Webb is to see the very early universe when the very first, you know, stars and galaxies were forming in one of the earliest epochs of the universe. But those objects, although they've taken a long time to get here, they were very dim. And so actually it was scientists who were studying the data from Hubble. You know, after we did the repair mission to Hubble, they had Hubble stare at a very dark patch of the sky. They called it the Hubble Deep Field. And they looked as deep as they could. You know, weeks and weeks of Hubble time were spent looking at some of the earliest galaxies that they could see, which was when the universe was about 1 billion years old. Well, those astronomers looking at the data said, you know, we really want to look farther back to when the universe, you know, had some of its earliest stars and galaxies, closer to when it was about 300 million years old. And they calculated to do that, number one, you couldn't look at visible light. You had to look at infrared light because the universe had this large accelerated expansion, the light has been stretched. The fabric of space-time is stretched. And so the light from the stars, which may have started out in the visible, is now in the infrared as space-time itself is stretched. And they calculated how many photons would be getting here. And they said, we need a telescope that's about 6.5 meters in size. And by the way, because it's infrared light that we're looking at, it has to be very cold. Mm-hmm. And the reason it's cold is because when objects are warm, they produce a lot of infrared light. There's something called black body emission, and it's a temperature dependent thing. So that's why you can use infrared glasses at night. They're great at night. You can see people with infrared glasses because your body at 98.6 degrees produces a lot of infrared light. Well, we don't want the mirror to be producing infrared light, so we have to cool it. And that's why we have to cool it to about minus 400 degrees Fahrenheit.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned earlier in our conversation that because of the size of these mirrors, they have to be folded to stow away in the rocket's nose cone before getting to space. Tell me a little bit about one of the major milestones your team reached recently when it comes to the folding and unfolding of these mirrors.
Yeah. So, you know, I mentioned earlier that we have these two wings. You know, each wing has three of these fairly large mirror segments. The mirror segments themselves, these 18 primary mirror segments, are each about 1.3 meters across. And there's three of them on each wing. But we actually just did the very last wing deployment. And this is actually the very last motorized deployment we'll be doing on the entire observatory as part of the process of demonstrating that we will be able to survive the vibration and the acoustic generated forces from launch. And so this is like what we call our final deployment test. And it happened to have been the wings that were the very final thing we deployed. And so this was the last test. We just completed it this week. And it demonstrates that everything works right and should deploy in space. And of course, on the ground, we have 1G, we have gravity. And so we have to think about the fact that in space, we'll be at 0G, things will be changing temperature. And, you know, we compensate for those effects when we do this testing and deal with those effects. But it's successfully deployed. And then we're actually now in the process of doing the final stowing of those, really the second wing. The first wing's already been stowed. And when we stow that second wing, at that point, the telescope and the primary mirror is done. Mm-hmm. There will be no more deployments. It's basically locked in for launch. Mm-hmm. And so that's why it was such a key milestone, because basically at this point, all of the mirrors and all of the deployment systems for the mirrors are all done doing their testing. Mm-hmm. And are ready.
It's got to be so, a sigh of relief for your team, huh?
Yeah, it is. And it's, you're always, you build confidence along the way. Mm-hmm. Every time you do a test, you're a little more confident. This test went extremely well. Mm-hmm. And so, we're feeling really good about, the telescope and about the deployments that we need to do with the mirrors. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is. It's a nice feeling. It's funny because on the one hand, it's a great relief, but we still have one more critical deployment to go, and that's the one we do in space. And I think that's really the one where we'll finally feel relieved. So
let's talk about that final deployment, because, right now the next major step for James Webb Space Telescope is getting shipped down to its launch facility and integration into the rocket. And then a launch, I think, October 31st is the planned date right now.
Right.
Once that happens, it's time to deploy this thing. What's that process like? And, what are you going to be looking for? How does this happen? And how quickly can you start collecting those photons?
Yeah, great question. So, first of all, there's the telescope, which has the mirrors, but there's also a really critical piece that actually deploys before the telescope mostly, which is the sun shield. This is a 5-layer membrane that's, when it's unfolded, is about the size of a tennis court. And those 5 layers of membrane are what allow us to cool the telescope down. We call it passively. It's kind of like a large umbrella in space that blocks the sun and the Earth and the moon. And so the very, during the very early part of the mission, one of the first things we do is actually, after we get power and communications, is we'll deploy the sun shield. But once that happens, and let me just say, all these big deployments I'm talking about, they're all happening in the first 2 weeks of the mission. So very early on, starting, after a couple of days, we'll be doing these deployments. And, first we'll deploy the sun shield, and then we'll deploy the telescope itself, which includes the wings and includes the secondary mirror. And those are pretty, straightforward deployments. They're, take maybe a few hours each. We lock them in place. Once we get them into position, there's kind of a way that we have for locking them in place. And then we're ready to start deploying the mirrors. The mirrors at about 2 weeks into the mission, just a little over that, we'll deploy the 18 primary mirror segments about a half inch forward. And the reason we do that is, I mentioned these mirrors are on actuators. Each mirror has 7 actuators on it. And the 7 actuators allow us to move the mirror around, kind of tip and tilt it. And there's also one in the center that allows us to just slightly change the radius of curvature of that mirror. Well, the mirrors during launch have to be what we call snub. They have to be kind of put against a hard stop. Mm-hmm. So that the launch vibration doesn't shake them too much. So the first thing we'll do about 2 weeks in is we'll move all 18 mirrors forward by about a half an inch. And that allows us to start the process of aligning the mirrors. But in order to align the mirrors, we need images. And we actually use the main science camera of Webb. It's called the near-infrared camera, NIRCam, as what we call our wavefront sensor. That's what gives us the information that tells us how to move the mirrors. Because when the mirrors are first deployed from one mirror to the next, they can be several millimeters from where they need to be. And ultimately, we need to take those 18 mirrors and position them using these special actuators as though they're a single monolithic mirror. So from one mirror to the next, they need to be aligned to a fraction of a wavelength of light. You know, that's like crazy.
It's a crazy small number, you know.
We're talking, you know, some people talk millimeters. We talk like millions of millimeters. Jeez. That's the kind of scale we're to. Yeah. And so, but it turns out we can do that using images from the near infrared camera, but that camera itself has to cool down. The detectors don't work at warm temperatures. So we're actually going to wait for the camera to cool down. It takes almost 30 days to get it cold enough. And then we can, a little after that, a few days after that, we'll start taking images even while the camera is still cooling. And we'll go through a whole process. It's called wavefront sensing and control. It takes about 3.5 months to completely align the telescope. And we've developed a whole, it's really a technology in and of itself. We built a separate test bed that looks a lot like Webb, except it's, instead of it being 6.5 meters in diameter, it's only 1 meter in diameter.
Mm-hmm.
But it has 18 segments, and we've rehearsed how we do this, these algorithms that we call them. And one of the really neat things about these algorithms is at the end of all these algorithms, the very last one we do, where we move the mirrors in these very small positions, we use a technique that was actually really perfected to help figure out the problem with Hubble. Because I don't know if you remember or know your history about Hubble, but when we launched Hubble, we found out that the primary mirror had a slightly wrong prescription. It had something called spherical aberration. And in order to figure out how to fix Hubble, to put what amounted to a set of contact lenses on Hubble, we actually came up with a method of taking defocused images using the telescope,
mm-hmm.
and analyzing those images using these special algorithms that we developed called phase retrieval. Well, it turns out those same algorithms, with some modifications for the fact that we're segmented, are what let us turn a telescope that's mostly aligned but not quite the right surface into one that's properly aligned, almost like going from an aberrated, you know, version of the telescope to a properly aligned telescope. And so that's the final algorithms that we'll use. I know it's kind of a neat,
fascinating, yeah,
connection. Yeah. So.
Well, so I mean, it sounds like there's quite a bit of work to be done once it is in space, from cooling down to, you know, aligning all of these mirrors, but totally going to be worth the wait, right, Lee? I mean, what are you most excited?
My God, yeah.
What are you most excited for to be able to peer into deep in the universe? What do you want to see first?
Well, let's see. You know, one thing that's amazing to me is looking at the list of, they call them the early release objects, the first scientific things they will do with Webb, which kind of show off its capabilities. And then also looking at what they call cycle one science, the science that astronomers proposed to do. There is a large number, you know, over 1,000 proposals, and they've selected several hundred that are going to be the first year's worth of images and scientific data that it takes. And I'll tell you, I look at every one of them and I'm like, wow, that would be a mission in and of itself. Mm-hmm. It is so cool. So, I mean, part of it for me is just, you know, how many different amazing things there are. I especially am interested in both the early universe, because I think, you know, it's just really fascinating that there's this period of time in the universe from when it was about 300 million years to about 1 billion years old that they call the Dark Ages, because we haven't been able to ever study it. We haven't had a telescope with the right wavelengths and sensitivity. And so we're going to go from Dark Ages to here's what it looks like. So that's really exciting.
Mm-hmm.
And also the exoplanet science, you know, the looking at planets around other stars, looking at their atmospheres, what are the atmospheres made of? I just think it's going to be really fascinating to find out whether the planets in our solar system are pretty typical of all planets, or whether there's like whole types of planets that we never even dreamed of in terms of what their atmospheres are and how things evolve. And I just think that's really going to be a very interesting thing to learn about. And it might tell us something maybe about our own planet. I don't know. So I'm really excited about that.
looking forward to all the really cool science about to be beamed back down from the James Webb Space Telescope. We've been speaking with Lee Feinberg. He's the Optical Telescope Element Manager for Webb at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center. Lee, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Oh, you're welcome. My pleasure.
Still to come, a look at the impact James Webb will have on science and our understanding of the universe. Are We There Yet? Is back in a minute. You're listening to Are We There Yet? Here on WMFE, America's Space Station. I'm Brendan Byrne. Scientists are eager to get their hands on the data James Webb promises to collect. So what's so special about this telescope? To talk about the future of space-based observations and the research ahead for James Webb, we're joined by Addy Dove, Josh Caldwell, and Jim Cooney. They're physicists at the University of Central Florida and host the podcast Walk About the Galaxy. Josh, Addy, Jim, good to have you again.
Happy to be here.
Good to see you.
Yeah.
So let's go back. I know we've talked about it before, but just to refresh our listeners, why is this such an exciting mission for scientists and astronomers and folks that work with telescopes? Why should we be excited about James Webb?
It's the next great space observatory, a huge mirror, and it's looking in a different part of the spectrum than Hubble did. So it's looking in the near and mid-infrared part of the wavelength region, where we'll see completely different processes and different things than Hubble was able to see.
Right. And those are very difficult wavelengths to see from Earth-based telescopes because Earth's atmosphere screws up a lot of observations in infrared. So this is a really great opportunity to see a lot of stuff that it's really hard to see from Earth.
Mm-hmm. What kind of things will we be able to see?
All kinds of things.
Oh, I'll tell you about the thing that I'm most excited about. I don't know. I'm sure that Josh and Eddie have different things that they're most excited about because they're planetary scientists. From the cosmology angle, this is super exciting because we're going to be able to see the stuff on the very hairy edge of the universe. That is the stuff that the stars that were born first in the universe. And this is a realm of time and space that we haven't been able to very well probe until now. So we get to see those first baby stars in the universe when the universe was only 30 million or maybe 300 million years old or something. We actually don't know very well, which is why this telescope is going to tell us a lot about that. And it's the reason it's so good at looking at that kind of stuff is that stuff is so far away that in the time it has taken the light to get from it to us, that light has been redshifted, that is stretched out because of the expansion of the universe. And so stuff that was in the visible part of the spectrum that we could normally see with like Hubble is now shifted into the infrared. And now we need James Webb.
Why is that so important, Jim? What can that kind of help cosmologists like yourself answer by seeing that far into the past?
Yeah, I mean, it tells us. I mean, we like I said, we have a pretty good snapshot of the universe when it was only 300,000 years old, the cosmic microwave background that many of your listeners have at least heard of, and we know what the universe looks like now. But the middle grounds are tough, and we've never been able to see this far back into the universe. It will help us refine our models of how the universe was born and how it evolves from the early times to now. And so this is very, very exciting.
Will it help with some of the terrifying things that you like to talk about all the time, Jim? Will this help us see black holes and super?
I do like to scare you, Brennan. Not so much. It is true, though, interestingly, that those first stars that are born in the universe are terrifyingly huge stars, generally. They tend to be much, much larger than our sun, even though In this age of the universe, stars are pretty small. So I don't know if big stars scare you, maybe the early universe is a scary place.
It's also from a time back when like things didn't really have substance. Like hydrogen wasn't, it's called the era of recombination because like hydrogen was dissociated and things were just, there were just protons and electrons flying around. And it was a complicated time. And
In the era before those stars were born, it was a terrifying time because it's just totally, like I said, Addy said, there weren't stars. If there's no stars, there's no galaxies, there's nothing. It's just totally dark. Oh, the dark ages of the universe. So that's kind of scary to be out in an empty void of total darkness. If I had a time machine, I do not go back to that time.
Yeah, we'll pass on that. Josh is a planetary scientist. What are you most excited about?
Very interested in what it's going to be seeing about planets around other stars. And so a lot of the observations are going to be looking at disks where planets are forming around other stars. And you know, if the latter half of the 20th century was sort of the golden age of planetary exploration in our own solar system, I think the first half of the 21st century is the golden age of exploration of planetary systems around other stars. And James Webb is going to be a huge part of that. We're going to be actually seeing planets that we know exist around some of these other stars in really great detail, not like imaging detail and seeing things like that, but learning so much about their composition, their temperatures and their history. So just looking at some of the list of the observing programs that are going on there is very exciting, you know, looking at the details of some of these planets, first and only multi-wavelength map of an sub-Earth and the atmosphere of a 17 million year old hot Jupiter. And so we're really getting into planetary science of planets around other stars, not just the Sun.
These are a lot of the candidates that have been picked out by exoplanet hunting telescopes, right? Like TESS and Kepler.
These are things that have been discovered by projects such as Kepler. Yes.
And which we really haven't gotten a good look aside from just knowing that they're there, right?
Knowing they're there, knowing their orbits, and a little bit about their mass, and that's about it from many of those initial sort of detection campaigns. Yeah.
Addie, what about you as a planetary scientist? What are you excited about?
Sure, I'll bring it even closer to home and talk about some of the exciting things we'll hopefully be able to see within our own solar system. So there's a lot of folks here, for instance, who have been getting some time on Webb to do solar system studies, looking at things like asteroids and comets, really understanding their compositions better. There's some nice overlap with a lot of the other rovers and spacecraft we've sent to planetary bodies. We typically have instruments in the infrared, so there will be really nice overlap with some of those and really understanding better things about the composition of things in our solar system. We always try to tie this a little bit more into like life, past and present life, and how sort of the environments for life could exist or have existed on other places. So like looking for signs of water and more organic molecules in these locations on Mars and small bodies is Webb will help us with those detections.
That was Addie Dove, Josh Caldwell, and Jim Cooney. They're physicists at the University of Central Florida and host the podcast Walk About the Galaxy. You can hear more of their podcast wherever you get this show or by visiting walkaboutthegalaxy.com. We should mention UCF is a financial sponsor of this show. Well, that's going to do it for this week's show. If you're not already, be sure to subscribe to this show's podcast feed and never miss an episode. Subscribe on NPR One, iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. We've got more space coverage online. Visit WMFE.org/space. You can also stay connected to this show on social media. Just give our Facebook page a like. It's Are We There Yet Podcast. We're also on Twitter and Instagram. The handle is at @AWTYSpace. Are We There Yet is a production of WMFE, America's Space Station. Editorial guidance this week from Matthew Petty, and the support for Are We There Yet comes from our listeners. Until next week, I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.